Hello, it's Friday the 19th of November and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-wo. The Prime Minister convened an emergency meeting with the heads of general hospitals in the capital region to secure additional beds for critical COVID-19 patients. We'll have more in our news briefing shortly. Then coming up for weekly economy review, we'll be looking at some new interesting data points from a recent spike in household income to university graduate employment rates. And then on Movie Spotlight, we'll be reviewing a debut directorial feature by a veteran actress in Korea, as well as the latest from the unique visual mind of Wes Anderson. We'll have all that and more on today's Korea 24. South Korea's Prime Minister held an urgent meeting with heads of hospitals in the greater metro area to ensure that there are enough beds for COVID-19 patients. This comes as the nation saw the number of new cases top the 3,000 mark for a third consecutive day. To give us a rundown of South Korea's latest measures to limit the spread of the virus, we're joined in the studio by KBS World Radio news editor Koo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Jang.
So how is the government planning to respond to this issue of patients with severe cases taking up hospital beds in the capital region then, Hee-jin?
Well, Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom convened an emergency meeting with the heads of 22 general hospitals in the capital region on Friday to secure additional beds for patients. The government pledged to flexibly manage all beds in the country without drawing a line between the capital region and outlying areas. The government designated two additional hospitals to treat serious cases and two more hospitals specializing in infectious diseases to obtain a total of 250 new beds. The Prime Minister also pledged state support in medical personnel and equipment and vowed to crack down once again on multipurpose facilities, restaurants and other venues that fail to adhere to social distancing guidelines.
And this is due to a recent surge of new infections, which the government expects to continually rise in the coming weeks. Can you break down the latest figures for us?
Yes, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency reported 3,034 more cases on Friday, down by more than 250 from the record high of the previous day, but still remaining in the 3,000s. The country's cumulative caseload rose to 409,099. The government is expecting the tally to rise steadily. Senior Health Ministry official Lee Gil said on Friday that the next 3 weeks will be critical. The government plans to resume a special antivirus measures inspection team for 4 weeks starting next week. And nevertheless, the government is pushing ahead with plans to resume in-person classes at all kindergartens and schools across the nation next Monday, allowing students to return to their classrooms full-time, the first such move in some 2 years.
Let's move on now to political headlines. Rival parties are wrapped up in a blame game after the ruling Democratic Party's presidential candidate backed down from his early proposal for the government to offer an additional round of universal COVID-19 relief payouts. So can you round up the latest developments for us?
Of course. DP leader Song Yong-gil on Friday said the retraction was inevitable after a review of the nation's fiscal status. He added that the payouts will have to be reconsidered following March 9th presidential elections, pledging support for small businesses through regional vouchers and state compensation. And the main opposition People Power Party slammed Lee for backtracking from his so-called populist pledge, urging the candidate to apologize for creating confusion among the public. Meanwhile, the rival parties ramped up pressure for corruption investigations into each other's presidential contenders. The DP called for a special parliamentary committee to look into allegations involving PPP candidate Yoon Sung-yeol's wife. The PPP pushed the DP to cooperate in launching a special counsel probe into the Songnam and land development scandal, which took place when Lee Jae-myung was mayor.
Meanwhile, prosecutors raided the ruling party's policy research office as part of another investigation into allegations that officials from the Gender Equality Ministry played a role in drawing up the party's presidential campaign pledges. So what more do we know at the moment?
Well, according to sources in legal circles, the Seoul Central District Prosecutor's Office sent investigators to the office earlier Friday to obtain relevant documents after the National Election Commission filed complaints against Vice Gender Equality Minister Kim Kyung-sun and an unidentified ministry official with the Supreme Prosecutor's Office for violating the election law. Now, this official, who is as yet unnamed, is suspected of requesting departments at the ministry to prepare a draft of policy pledges upon a request from a member of the DP's policy committee. The official allegedly delivered the documents to the committee member. The NEC has accused the vice minister of overseeing tasks in connection to these pledges, such as convening a meeting within the ministry.
Turning to international relations now, US President Joe Biden said he is mulling a diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympic Games in Beijing. Now, this is not welcome news for South Korea, as it could hamper a push to arrange a formal declaration of an end to the Korean War. So what did President Biden say exactly?
Well, Biden made the remarks to reporters on Thursday during a meeting with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau at the White House when asked about the possibility of a boycott, saying that's something we're considering. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki also said on Thursday in a press briefing that the consideration is due to concerns about China's human rights abuses. She added that the matter was not discussed during last week's summit talks between Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping. Now, if the U.S. actually decides on a boycott, it may adversely affect South Korea's efforts to coordinate a declaration of a formal end to the Korean War, as well as its plans to improve ties between the two Koreas and between North Korea and the U.S. through these Olympic Games. A diplomatic boycott means that the U.S. would not send an official government delegation to the Games, but would allow U.S. athletes to compete. The last time the U.S. fully boycotted the Olympics was ahead of the Summer Games in Moscow back in 1980, when President Jimmy Carter protested the Soviet Union's military presence in Afghanistan. South Korea stood alongside the U.S. in the boycott.
And turning now to another boycott, but on a smaller scale, senior officials from the U.S. and Japan reaffirmed the importance of trilateral cooperation with South Korea on denuclearizing North Korea a day after Japanese diplomats refused to take part in a three-way press event in a protest directed at Seoul for a different issue. Can you tell us more?
Well, the U.S. State Department issued a statement saying that senior diplomats from the U.S. and Japan reaffirmed the importance of a trilateral cooperation with South Korea following two-way discussions between U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman and Japanese Vice Foreign Minister Takeo Mori. Now, the statement comes a day after Mori pulled out of a planned a news conference with Sherman and South Korean Vice Foreign Minister Choi Jong-un over a conflict with Seoul following a visit to South Korean islets of Dokdo by the head of the Korean National Police Agency. The top nuclear envoys of the U.S. and Japan, Sung Kim and Takehiro Funakoshi, also held phone discussions regarding North Korea issues on Thursday, according to NHK reports. In addition to issues on North Korea, the two sides reportedly affirmed close coordination with South Korea on these matters.
And finally, the top trade officials from South Korea and the U.S. held talks in Seoul on Friday ahead of the 10th anniversary of their bilateral free trade agreement. Can you give us the details?
Yes, Trade Minister Yohan Gu and U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai convened the 6th South Korea-U.S. FTA Joint Committee to check up on the deal nearly 10 years after it took effect in March of 2012. This is the first visit to South Korea by a U.S. Trade Representative since November 2010 and a first by a senior economic or trade official under the Joe Biden administration. According to the ministry, trade between the two sides expanded 29% from $101.9 billion in 2012 to $131.6 billion last year. The two sides also discussed establishing a new channel to consult on trade issues pertaining to supply chains, the digital sector, and climate change, agreeing to reinforce strategic partnerships in respective areas.
We wrap it up there for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
It's time now for us to look at some of the key economic issues from the week in our Friday in-depth segment, Weekly Economy Review. This week, we take a look at South Korea's household income figures, which grew sharply in the third quarter. Then we'll look at how 6 out of 10 adults in Korea do not feel they'll be able to climb the socio-economic ladder. And we'll also delve into a report that paints a bleak picture of university graduate employment rates. To help us unpack all of these issues today, we have economics professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea joining us in the studio. Professor Yang, hello.
Happy to be here.
Let's start with a quick update on the week's stock market in Korea. Professor, how did the KOSPI and KOSDAQ fare this week?
Okay, well, KOSPI was up Monday and Friday, but it was down during Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. There was a gain of 1% more than 1% on Monday, but a loss of more than 1% on Wednesday. So all in all, things about stayed the same overall. If you count week to week, it ended today at 2,971.02. For the entire week, it rose by 0.07%. KOSDAQ, it had a fairly good week. It was up every day except Wednesday. It ended today 1,041.92. For the week, it went up by 3.3%. U.S. dollar, it ended today at 1,185.30 won per dollar. For the week, it depreciated by 0.5%.
Moving on to our first main topic now, Statistics Korea announced on Thursday that the nation's household income in the third quarter this year grew at its fastest on-year pace since the government began compiling such data in 2006. The average monthly income of a household consisting of one person or more was roughly 4.73 million won, up by 8% on-year. The agency said this was due to the recovery from the pandemic, as well as the government's emergency relief funds. But Professor, can you help us look a bit deeper into these numbers?
Okay, well, as you said, overall income on the average for all the households rose by about 8.0%. It's really interesting to break this down to income levels. Korea typically breaks down income levels to five categories, each quintile. Rise of income for the poorest quintile, the first quintile, rose by 21.5%, while the richest quintile rose only by 5.7%. But amount-wise, the average income for the poorest quintile was only about 1.1 million won per month, while for the richest quintile, it was about 10 million won per month. So amount-wise, the richest quintile earned about nine times more than the poorest quintile. Labor income and business income rose on average for all households by 6.2% and 3.7% respectively, but transfer income rose by 25.3% on the average for all the quintiles, presumably because of universal relief payment as well as strengthened welfare payments that we've seen in the last few years in the Moon administration. The largest component of income is labor income, and overall, on the average, it rose by 6.2%, but this is relatively good news. For the poorest quintiles, first and second, it rose by 22.6% and 9.5% respectively, but the richest quintile also did fairly well. Their labor income rose by 7.5%. In fact, the middle income was where it didn't do so well. Mm. Third and fourth quintile only rose by 1.5% and 4.7%. And you can say that this represents the K-shaped recovery where the very poor people who did very badly, their incomes are coming back up. The very richest, they've always done well. The middle income, they're staying about the same. They didn't do badly, but they didn't do well, so they're not recovering all that much either. And then for government transfers, this is, I think, one of the more interesting figures in the report. The lowest quintile, the poorest 20%, received about 559,000 won per household. And the second quintile the fourth quintile, had the highest payment per household at 619,000 won per household. So except for the richest, the amount of transfer that they received from government actually went up as your income went up. The richest quintile, they received a little less than the first quintile, 543,000. And the reason is that the amount of money you got didn't depend on your income, except for the very richest. About the 12% of the richest people didn't get any relief payment. But for the people who did get relief payment, it depended on how many people you had in the household rather than how much income you made. Mm. And typically, people in the middle class or who are doing slightly better than middle class, they have children in their household, so it's three or four person households, whereas the poorest people, they either live alone or they're old couples. So they're only one or two people households. So per household, the poorer households actually received less money. And then consumption-wise, consumption spending did not change as much as income. On average, while the income rose by 8%, consumption only rose by 4.9%. And as somewhat expected, the consumption growth rate for the poorer households were greater than the consumption increase for the richer households.
Okay, so then very briefly, what does this mean going forward then for Korea?
Okay, well, because we will not have a universal relief payment in the fourth quarter. Also, we will probably have worse job figures. October showed that while the total number of jobs went up, but the full-time jobs actually fell. I don't think the labor payment will rise as much as it did in the third quarter. So look for either very much slower growth in income or perhaps even a negative growth in income.
Okay, so you mentioned their income brackets, and that leads us into another survey by Statistics Korea that caught the eye of many this week. In a survey by the agency, it said 60.6% of adults in Korea felt that they had little to no chance of moving up the socioeconomic ladder, no matter how hard they tried. More than half also said it would be unlikely even for their children's generation. This is perhaps a concerningly high number, but it is actually an improvement from the same survey 2 years ago, where almost 65% of this surveyed said that they were pessimistic about climbing up. So what do you read into this data then, Professor? Is the situation improving, or is it still more a damning assessment of social mobility in Korea?
A bit of both. In these type of surveys, you can roughly say about half of it is due to private impression and about half of it is due to fact. If you take a survey, do you think you're rich? Then typically, even people who are well above median income say that they feel that they're poor. So a lot of this is just a private impression of how they're doing. There actually was an interesting story in New York Times about global survey such as this last week. And it actually turns out that people who are most optimistic are young people in poor countries, which are growing.
Right.
And the reason is that they really feel that they have an opportunity to climb up the ladder. But in a stable country, and most advanced countries are stable, you really don't see too many changes, and that includes people on the very bottom climbing up the ladder to a richer quintile. So this is partially impression, but partially also it's dealing with the facts. In Korea, we typically said that hard study means success, but that doesn't necessarily mean much anymore because even the rich people are studying hard. And when everybody is studying hard, richer people have an advantage because they can hire better tutors and better education. And then Korea does not have a flexible labor market. So if you do not have good qualifications, then you may not be able to get a good job, and then you'll be stuck in a badly paying job forever. So we definitely need some flexibility in the labor market if people want to move up. Also, another factor that can move people up very quickly is entrepreneurship, where you can found a company that succeeds, but it's really difficult to found a company in Korea and make it succeed. Partially, it's a problem with capital. Partially, it's a problem with competitive factors. The larger companies have such a competitive advantage that smaller companies feel that they have no hope of doing well.
So for a healthy economy, then, does that mean that we need more social mobility? And then should the government be doing more to try and improve this impression that Korean people are having at the moment?
Well, so if you take what I said before in the last question then, and try to get political policy out of it, then then what we need are labor reforms, better education programs, targeted income and education assistance, better schools in disadvantaged neighborhoods, regulatory reforms, especially concerning startups of companies. And because you also want companies which do not do well to fail as quickly as possible, regulatory reform which help companies fail as quickly as possible, and then for entrepreneurs not to get stuck in bankruptcy. Now, some of this is not controversial. If you say that we need better schools, especially in poorer neighborhoods, you're not going to get too much argument. But say that you need labor reforms where you can fire people easier. Say that you need regulatory reforms where people who are in bankruptcy can get out of bankruptcy faster. You'll have a lot of resistance. And that's because a lot of people, even though they say they want movement, they also want stability. And when you have too much stability, you don't have movement.
Okay, there was another report that came out this week that perhaps feeds into this survey about feeling that they can't move up the social ladders. A report from the Korea Economic Research Institute showed that when it comes to the employment rate for university graduates in South Korea, they ranked 31st among 37 OECD members. So despite a university degree, the employment rate was among the lowest for OECD countries. The institute cited a mismatch between graduate majors and job openings as the major reason. To give a bit more detail, the employment rate for Koreans aged 25 to 34 with university diplomas stood at 75.2% in 2020. That's lower than 90.6% for Britain, 88.4% for Germany, and 87.8% for Japan. So looking at those figures then, Professor, is this a concerning report?
In a sense, it is. Following up on the last question as well, you know, there's usual reasons why university grads do not have jobs, rigid job market and tight labor laws and regulations which discourage employers from hiring, low labor productivity which divides jobs into high-paying desirable jobs which young people want, and lower-paying undesirable jobs that right now have vacancies but no one chasing them. And due to this job market rigidity, young people, after they graduate, they may decide to keep on trying to get a good job for 1 to 3 years, staying unemployed, because once they get into a badly paid sector, they have to stay there. But I want to point out one more problem that is not particularly pointed out in this report, which is Korea is, in a sense, overeducated. And this is actually not a good thing for a college professor to say, but 29.8% of 25 to 34-year-olds in Korea have college diplomas. That's highest in the OECD. Now, we mentioned other countries, you have higher employment rate for college grads, but only about 46% of 25 to 34-year-olds have college diplomas on the average in the OECD. Mm. We mentioned Great Britain. They only have 55.8% of young people who have college degrees. Germany, it's only 34.9%. Japan, it's 62.5%, so they're very close to Korea. But you have to remember, Japan is suffering from a lack of young people because of their demographic problem. Mm. So in Korea, college degree, in a sense, is like a high school degree in other countries. A lot of people have it. So the fact that Korea has a lower employment of college grads represent part of that. Not every job in the economy needs a college degree. But because everybody in Korea has a college degree and people don't want to get into those ordinary jobs, you're going to have a lot of unemployment for people with a college degree. And that's what I think is partially being reflected in these numbers.
So then what can be done about that? We invest a lot into our education. We invest a lot into going to college then. But then to not be able to get a job afterwards would be not good for society. So is there something that the government can do? The Institute actually says that the government should relax regulations on university quotas because they're saying that's an issue. What do you make of that?
Well, I think you're going to be having a similar problem even if you did loosen up the quotas. But loosening up the quotas would be better because, people would be finding jobs that companies want. That's what companies have been complaining for a long time. Because of the quota system, they say they need, say, more people who have taken a degree in computer science or physical sciences, but number of those people are limited because of the quota system. So loosening up that quota system will help part of the problem. Part of the problem is that Korean students, because they want to get into universities, they're focused on testing. And, well, after you graduate from high school, after you graduate from college, you'll become a world leader in taking tests, but not necessarily doing your job. So getting less emphasis on tests may be better, but right now the Korea's emphasis on transparency, fair competition means that you still have to focus on testing. So that I don't think will happen in the near future. But still, fundamentally, the problem is I'm not sure if you can create that many high-paying, high-valuated jobs that the college grads want, because at least some percentage of jobs will have to remain low-skilled jobs because that's what the economy needs. I mean, economy, yes, they do need scientists, they need researchers, they also need people to man the cash registers.
Well, some interesting reports and figures we looked into this week, but we'll have to wrap it up there. Professor, thank you as always for helping us dig deeper into that data, and we'll see you again next time.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 23.64 points or 0.80% on Friday, closing the week at 2,971.02. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 9.15 points or 0.89% to close at 1,041.92. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 4.9 won against the dollar, ending the day at 1,185.3 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's Korea Trending, our daily segment where we round up some of the other news stories and headlines that have been looked up online by people in Korea today. And for that, we have Walter Lee joining us in the studio today. Walter, hello. It's great to see you.
Hello, Jung. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. So what topics have you brought for us today?
Okay, so we'll talk about an expert claiming that the first known person infected with COVID-19 was a seafood vendor in Wuhan and not an accountant as previously reported. We'll also check out the latest development in Korean-American singer Yoo Sung-jun's effort to enter South Korea. And finally, we'll talk about the KT Wiz winning their first Korean series title.
Okay, so we start with an interesting new research that questions where the COVID-19 pandemic might have started. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so an expert on the origins of viral epidemics has claimed that the first known person infected with COVID-19 was actually a female seafood vendor at the Huanan Market in Wuhan, China. Michael Warraby, head of the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona, made the claim in a report that was published in the journal Science on Thursday. Previously, it had been reported that a male accountant who lived some 30 kilometers south of the market was the first known case, in line with a report drafted by the World Health Organization.
Okay, so what kind of data had Warraby looked at to come to such a conclusion?
Well, he cited Chinese media reports that covered the first known COVID-19 infections at Wuhan, South China seafood wholesale market, and came to presume that the female vendor became infected days before the male accountant. Warraby said that the symptoms had the man experienced on December 8th were likely related to dental issues, and his actual symptoms related to COVID-19 began on December 16th, or a few days after the vendor fell sick. This indicates, according to Warraby, that the man was infected through community transmission after the virus had begun spreading from the market.
Okay, so this conclusion was reached using secondary information then, rather than any primary evidence gathered himself, which is, of course, the best that can be done currently, as the Chinese authorities are not allowing scientists access to the region. So how has the professor's piece been received by other pandemic experts?
Well, according to New York Times, a number of experts, including a World Health Organization-appointed pandemic investigator, supported Ruby's paper. However, The Daily was quick to add that some said that the evidence he presented was not enough to say indisputably how the pandemic began. The Daily quoted Columbia University virologist W. Ian Lipkin as saying that Warraby has done an excellent job of reconstructing what he can from the available data, and it's a reasonable hypothesis as any, but he added that he doesn't think we're ever going to know what's going on because it's 2 years ago and it's still quite murky.
Right, so this research is not conclusive, but what it does do is support the theory that the outbreak originated from an animal rather than the controversial lab leak theory that gained more traction earlier this year, because it directly links the first case to that market rather than the accountant who had no connection to the market. So it's an interesting development, but we still seem far from any sort of definitive answer yet. Okay, moving on, what else do you have for us today?
All right, so Korean-American singer Yoo Sung-jun has again requested the South Korean government to allow him to enter the country. The request came through Yoo's lawyers on Thursday based on the claim that it's unclear whether the singer had received the notification of his mandatory military service from the Military Manpower Administration in the past. Yoo's lawyers made the request during a hearing of a suit that Yoo has filed with the Seoul Administrative Court against the South Korean Consulate General in Los Angeles, California. His lawyers said there is no objective data proving that Yoo received the notice to have him serve his mandatory military service.
Okay, so Yoo is a very controversial figure that is very famous in Korea, and we've talked about him on the show before, but for any listeners who might not know, can you briefly explain for us who Yoo is?
Yeah, sure thing. So Yoo enjoyed immense popularity in the early 2000s and had repeatedly expressed intent to serve his mandatory military service. But he came under fire when he gave up his South Korean citizenship for a U.S. citizenship in January 2002, shortly before he was set to enlist, and has since then been banned from entering South Korea. In a bid to contest such a move, Yoo requested for an F-4 visa, but after that request was denied. He filed a suit last fall with the Seoul Administrative Court against the South Korean Consulate General in LA for refusing his request.
Right, so it was essentially concluded that he had intentionally dodged his mandatory military service and therefore would not be allowed to come back to Korea, especially under the F-4 visa, which is a special renewable visa for overseas Koreans, which offers many more rights than some other types of visas. So has the government responded to these latest claims then?
Yes, it has. So in a statement sent to reporters on Thursday, the Military Manpower Administration said Yoo's claims are not true, saying Yoo was set to enlist in 2001, but the singer postponed his enlistment citing personal reasons. The agency was apparently stressing that Yoo's claim don't line up as one can request to delay enlistment only if they've received a notification for the due duty. The Seoul court is set to hold the last hearing of the case on December 16th.
Okay, so his controversial legal battle to return to Korea continues on. Okay, let's continue on to our final trending story now. What else do you have for us?
Yeah, so our final story is about the KT Wiz becoming the 2021 champions of the Korea Baseball Organization, or KBO for short. The Wiz beat the Doosan Bears 8-4 in Game 4 at Golchok Sky Dome in Seoul on Thursday in the best of seven Korean series. The club claimed its first ever championship after seven seasons of being in the league, sweeping the Bears in four straight games while also finishing first in the regular season.
Yes, this is a major feat for the Wiz. As you said, just 7 years old as a franchise, and when they first joined the KBO, they were dead last for a long while as well.
That's right, and they stayed at the bottom for three straight seasons. But things started to pick up when manager Lee Kang-chol took the helm. The Wiz managed to climb to sixth place in 2019 before surging to second last year, the very first time that the squad ever made it to the postseason, actually.
Yes, and now they are Korean Series champions. The Most Valuable Player Award of the series was also announced. Who received the honour this year?
That would be KT infielder Park Kyung-soo, though he didn't compete in Thursday's match due to a leg injury, which many thought could have jeopardised a potential sweep. Park had garnered most votes after showing remarkable performance in the two previous games. In Game 2, the veteran second baseman had saved the team with his stellar defense, and in Game 3, he drew first blood with his solo homer in the top of the fifth. Despite the loss, the Bears also made history as they became the only team to have reached the finals 7 years in a row.
Well, we'll have another wrap-up of the series on Monday for our sports roundup segment with Yoo Ji-ho, as well as look at the whole KBO season as a whole. But for now, we'll leave it there for Career Trending. Walter, thank you for those updates, and we'll see you again next time.
See you next time.
We continue on now to our Friday feature, Movie Spotlight, reviewing some of the latest releases at the Korean box office and online. And that means it's time to bring in our ever-wonderful film critics. Jason Bechevace and Darcy Biquette are here in the studio with us. Gentlemen, it's great to see you.
It's great to be here.
Hello.
Hello, Jason. So today we start with a new local release, and it's a comedy called Perhaps Love, or Jangleman Romance in Korean. It stars Ryu Seung-ryong, but it's actually the director that is grabbing the attention because it's the debut feature by actress Cho Eun-ji. Now, Darcy, of course, it's not uncommon for actors to branch out into directing in their careers. Hollywood has many examples, of course, like Clint Eastwood and Ben Affleck, and Korea has its fair share as well, such as Kim Yoon-suk, Park Eun-jin and Yoo Ji-tae, but there's still interest when someone does make that leap. So Darcy, what can you tell us about the actress and now director?
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of hers. You know, not everyone will be familiar with her name, but I think they might recognize her face because she's appeared in over like 40 films up until this point. You know, often as supporting characters rather than the main characters. And so it's not uncommon that I'll start watching a film and, you know, like her name wasn't on the poster, but then she pops up and I'm always really happy to see her. She made her debut back in the year 2000 with Im Sang-soo's second feature film, Tears. And, you know, since then, I think her most memorable roles have probably been in films like Driving with My Wife's Lover, The Concubine, The Villainess. She had a good role. Mm. And then in recent years, she shot a short film called Two Nights, Three Days, which was well received. She's also credited as a co-writer on the screenplay of this kind of unfairly neglected Night of the Undead. Chuk Chian and Ingan Nuripan, which I really love. Mm. Yeah, and then so she, and now she's out with her feature film. You know, she doesn't act in this film herself, but I think that she's drawn together a really talented kind of ensemble cast.
Okay, so she's been building up her career behind the camera. So let's talk about the film itself. Jason, can you tell us about the story?
Yeah, it gets a little bit complicated because it's built around, you know, a rather tangled set of relationships. So we've got the main character played by kind of A-list star Yoo Sung-yong. He's a famous novelist in this film. Kim Yeon, who hasn't published a new book in several years since his divorce with his ex-wife, Mie. Now, meanwhile, Mie is secretly carrying on a relationship with her ex-husband's best friend, who's also his publisher. And Kim Yeon, for his partner, has remarried, but his wife and daughter are living abroad, and he still can't seem to forget Mie. So now Kim Yeon and Mie also have a 19-year-old son who's a bit freaked out about his parents' emotional lives.
Right. As you might be sometimes.
And is dealing with some romantic confusion of his own. And then finally, Kim Hyun meets a very talented young writer and they decide to write a book together. But when the writer confesses his feelings to the homophobic older man, things get rather awkward. Yeah, I mean, it's not easy to try and explain what's really going on in this film.
So a lot of complicated relationships indeed. Darcy, then, there's a lot going on. Does it all come together?
I mean, it kind of does. I thought it didn't at the beginning, and so it took a little while for the film to get started, I thought. But for me, I did start to really go with the film. I think just because it takes a really sympathetic view of human weaknesses in a way that is very easy to relate to.
What do you mean?
And yeah, just because, I mean, you know, romance is complicated always. The film shows that well. And it shows both positive and negative aspects of these different characters. And, you know, everybody's kind of hovering on the edge of a breakdown in this film, it seems. But all of the characters are well defined. You know, it's kind of walking a line. There are moments where, you know, there are moments of slapstick comedy. There are moments of kind of more subtle comedy. But ultimately, it's all just about how the different characters fit together. And so I thought it worked. I imagine this is a film that's going to divide audiences, but for me, it worked.
So, right, it worked for Darcy there. Jason, what about you?
Yeah, I came out of the screen thinking, yeah, I like this film, some issues with it, But I enjoyed it. I think for me in Korea, I find it a very vibrant place, very vibrant culture. And there's just a lot of emotions around, a lot of energy. And I think that plays out in this film really, really well. The conversations they have, the conflicts they have, the awkwardness, everything about it. I think it's just really, really intriguing. And I love the sense of humor that many of these characters have too, and certainly the director, I think. I mean, like Darcy said, on the one hand, it's quite slapstick and silly, and yet on the other hand, the humor gets quite dry. And sometimes when that kind of humor collides, it doesn't always work. I mean, Lee Byung-hun's films, I think, are an example of that. I think for Korean audiences, they work really well. But for me, his comedies don't really resonate with me personally. Mm. But I felt here it worked really effectively, even though, you know, it took me a bit of a while to adjust to the film's tone. The plot does get a bit kind of convoluted and a bit ridiculous. But by the end of it, you're kind of like, well, I don't care. I'm having a good time.
Well, I do think comedy can be so difficult at times, because when it's good, it works so well, everyone's laughing. But when it doesn't, there's deafening silence.
Right.
And you feel the weight of that silence. Darcy, that's quite promising then for the director.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, I can imagine that on the page, you know, that's the other thing about comedy. Like, on the page, it may look really good, and then sometimes it doesn't work in the film itself. But, you know, in order to make that work, you need to have some talent as a director and to have a good sense of timing, and then how to kind of edit these scenes together in a way to create an overall structure to the film.
And putting together a large cast as well for this film.
Yeah, it has a great cast. And again, most of them aren't really famous. I mean, there are a number of kind of walk-on roles as well, in addition to the main cast. I mean, I really liked, personally, especially the ex-wife, Mie, played by Onara. I thought that she played the role with a good sense of kind of lived experience.
The cast is great. I mean, Lee Young for me as well. I mean, she's just so intense in this film. Often you see her, I mean, she can often play these quite deep and serious characters, but in here, she's she's very eccentric and yeah, she's quite intense. And and some of the scenes that she has in the Norde Bang are just really, really quite entertaining.
Great. Well, that was our review for Perhaps Love. Let's move on to our second film now. And if we thought we'd seen a large ensemble cast for the last film, this film takes it to an altogether new level. It's the latest from the director Wes Anderson, who is known for working with large groups of famous actors, such as the Royal Tenenbaums and the Grand Budapest Hotel. And his newest film has, which has just hit theatres in Korea, it's called The French Dispatch, described as a love letter to journalism. So, Jason, can you set this one up for us as well?
Yeah, so we've got Wes Anderson, who is has a very distinct sense of style that's very clear, and we're kind of thrown in it instantly. It's so beautiful to look at. He loves books. He's really into literature and reading, and so here he's kind of created a sort of a homage to what, you know, the famous magazine New Yorker had in its heyday, or was in its heyday. And the film itself is set in France. I think Wes Anderson spends quite a lot of time in Paris. And yeah, the story is... I went in, I've had a really busy couple of weeks, so I was really quite tired, and I was in the worst state of mind to watch this film, I wasn't expecting it to be so kind of all over the place, which it is. And I think some critics like it a lot, and others, I think, are less keen on it. But essentially, it's very episodic. You've got different episodes, and there are various kind of different tones in the film. We've got black and white to color, and aesthetically I've never seen a film where that works so well. And so yeah, from live action to animation, but there is kind of an overarching story, but it's essentially told in several different chapters.
So a story that's perhaps a bit all over the place, as Jason described it. Darcy, also just some of the stars in this film, if we just look through the list, it includes Benicio del Toro, Adrian Brody, Tilda Swinton, Frances McDormand, Timothy Chalamet, Jeffrey Wright, Bill Murray, Owen Wilson. I could go on. I have more names on this list, but I'll leave it there. Darcy, does it work having this ensemble this big, or does it risk becoming overwhelming and, again, just a bit all over the place?
Well, it's funny. I had a much better reaction to it than Jason did, I think.
Right. Okay.
Well, yeah. Sorry. Go on.
And it was interesting. Reading the review in the New York Times by A.O. Scott, he described it as cilantro, kind of, and like either you like cilantro or you don't like cilantro. And Wes Anderson's style is kind of like that, and but it is kind of overwhelming. I mean, that's the thing about this film. In his other movies, you know, because it's one long narrative, like even as all these things are different happening at the same time and new characters are coming in, like once you sort of get oriented in the story, you can just kind of follow that story through to the end. But here it takes a lot of mental effort to kind of restart every 30 minutes with a completely new story and a completely new characters and with all the things that are happening on the screen. So I think that, yeah, it helps to have gotten a good night's sleep for watching the film.
I'm sure
it's better in a second viewing.
I did like the film. I mean, stylistically, it's a work of art. You know, it's so beautiful. Just so much attention to detail. It is convoluted, but I think at the same time, I think the storytelling is really, really interesting. And there's so much I want to get out of the film, which I will on a second and third viewing, because it does kind of, it's all kind of interrelated. And even though we do have these like separate kind of episodes, and the acting is terrific as well. I mean, Tilda Swinton, she's just fantastic. For those who've seen Snowpiercer, I think they'll see some similarities to her role in that. I liked it a lot. I think it's a really fascinating film. But I do agree with Darcy. You need to have a good night's sleep before watching it, because it does require a lot of concentration.
I mean, in my personal experience with the Wes Anderson films, they always seem to be two powerful forces pushing against each other. One is the story and characters, and the other is the very striking visual aesthetic. And sometimes when the balance works, it's really great. For example, I think Grand Budapest Hotel really got that balance right. And I think
Absolutely.
That's one of the reasons why it was the most successful among his films. But sometimes the balance doesn't quite fit. I get a feeling that this might be more towards the latter, Darcy.
Yeah, I think he has kind of a soft spot in his heart for chaos as well. And so he likes to create chaos within his films. Mm. And again, when you know everything's working together and kind of feeding into each other, that it does work really well. I mean, this film, I think it's definitely kind of a film for his fans. I don't see it as right. much of a crossover film. Although it's interesting, I mean, I'm very curious to see how this movie does in Korea this time around, because Grand Budapest Hotel was a huge hit when it came out. It sold like over 800,000 tickets. But his other films are all kind of, you know, like 20, 30,000, 40,000 tickets. And, you know, this film sold 12,000 on its opening Thursday. So that's...
Yeah, and I'm curious about the subtitles as well, because the dialogue is... it's very complex and it's very, very well, you know, written, and the characters are very articulate and delivery is fantastic. But catching that through the subtitles must be really, really difficult, because obviously there's only a certain amount of time that the subtitles were up on there.
We'll see if it does win over Korean fans. Well, that film was called The French Dispatch, and it's out now in theatres in Korea. That's where we'll leave it for Movie Spotlight this week. Jason, Darcy, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
It's time now for us to wrap up this week by looking ahead to what's happening next week in our Friday closing segment next week from Seoul. And for that, we have our staff editor, Mark Wilson Chair, with us in the studio now. Mark, hello. It's great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
So what are we looking at first for next week?
President Moon Jae-in will hold a town hall meeting on Sunday, and it'll be broadcast live by KBS from 7:10 p.m., dubbed Dialogue with the People. The president plans to have candid discussions over ways to overcome the COVID-19 pandemic, quarantine efforts, and issues regarding people's livelihoods. The 100-minute event will be attended by some 300 citizens, roughly 200 in person, fully vaccinated, and the rest, around 100, virtually. This would be the president's second town hall meeting since the first of its kind, held in November 2019. Since it's being held less than 100 days until the next presidential election, presidential officials say that Moon won't be discussing matters relating to the election, nor the issues that could affect it.
Yeah, so a rare unscripted public Q&A with the public for President Moon on Sunday. We'll be breaking down the key points from that event on our Monday in-depth analysis segment, so do join us again then for that. Meanwhile, what else is set to happen next week, Mark?
Costa Rica's president, Carlos Alvarado Quesada, will make a state visit to South Korea next week to hold talks with President Moon. President Quesada, who's 41, by the way, he was signed in at 38, so super young, he'll arrive on Sunday for his four-day trip and hold a summit with President Moon next Tuesday. It'll mainly focus on boosting bilateral economic cooperation, particularly in the fields of space and hydrogen technologies. The two leaders are also expected to discuss ways to strengthen diplomatic cooperation, as well as boost collaboration on global issues like climate change.
So another important diplomatic event to look out for. Let's look at one more event before we go. What else is happening?
Next Thursday, the government will launch a formal discussion on whether to prohibit dog meat consumption. The topic will be brought to the table at a cabinet meeting presided over by Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom. This discussion, of course, follows President Moon's suggestion to review the controversial practice in September. Now remember, South Korea has its Animal Protection Act, but it's more aimed to prevent what are considered cruel forms of slaughter towards dogs and cats, but not to prevent dog meat consumption itself.
Right, so it seems the debate over this issue is continuing to pick up steam. We'll wrap it up there, Mark. Thank you for that roundup, and we'll see you again next week.
Talk to you then.
And that brings us to the end of another week here on Korea 24. But of course, join us again on Monday, where we'll be back to continue to bring you the latest updates and analysis from Korea. But until then, we hope you have a great weekend. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.